Hello and welcome to The Conduit Studio. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a diverse community of people passionate about positive impact. We're recording this conversation live from COP26 as part of our efforts to bring you cutting-edge content, insights, and expertise throughout the conference. Today, I'm joined by Daphne Frias, a climate justice and disability activist. Daphne is 23 years old and is unapologetically Latina. She's a youth activist and is a proud champion for the disabled community, being a wheelchair user herself. In 2019, she was appointed as the New York State Director for March for Our Lives and completed her tenure in June 2020. She is also part of the Generation Climate Initiative, and we are delighted to welcome her into the Conduit Studio today. So it's such a privilege and so delightful to be able to have a quick conversation here today. And I wanted to, you and I just shared a panel as judges in a New York Times debate on whether democratic and authoritarian regimes are better placed to deal with the challenges of climate change. And I think we both instinctually in different ways had to grapple with the question about the youth and young yes. people, and you made the point in one way and I made the same point in a different way, which is how do you think about the rights of future generations, people mm-hmm. who are young today but people who are not yet even born and exactly. whose rights and existence will be jeopardized unless we act on this problem. And so I wanted to start by asking you maybe not the usual question that people ask you, which is, you listened to that debate about whether democratic or authoritarian regimes would be better to address climate change. As a young person, does it change your answer that you think we're out of time and that you're young, or do you have a view on which is better regardless?
I think coming from the States, I grew up very disillusioned with our democratic government and felt at a very young age that our government wasn't listening to us and didn't support a future that included our visions. However, as I got older and I was able to find agency within the democratic system, and I think that's the key to the question. It's not whether the system itself is better, which one leads to more agency. I think that's the better question. For me, as I spoke in my intervention on the panel, I have been able to become an elected official in my district. And I think about friends in other countries and other parts of the globe who simply for speaking out about the climate crisis is a risk to their lives and their family. And understanding that, you know, I've been able to now not only represent what I feel, but the feelings of my fellow community members, that's an immense privilege to me. So, yes, while I do feel the urgency that time is running out and I experience a huge amount of climate anxiety, I also think the very existence of my generation is what gives me hope to keep going forward.
So now let's take a step back and start the conversation where I should have started, which is tell us a little bit about your story. What put you into politics with a small p? What made you yeah. want to be an elected representative, and why climate has become such an important animating struggle in your life?
Sure. So I was born and raised in West Harlem in New York City. I am second generation Dominican American. Spanish is my first language, and where I live in West Harlem is still predominantly a Hispanic, Black and Brown community. So my culture and my community are first and foremost in all of my activism and all of my organizing work. And as I grew up, I was experiencing the effects of environmental racism. However, I didn't even have the language or knowledge to understand that what I was experiencing was environmental racism. And it wasn't until I went off to high school in a lower part of Manhattan, a more affluent community, that I was able to starkly realize the differences between my community that I call home and my family has called home for over 60 years and the place where I was going to high school and receiving this education. I was keenly aware of the food deserts and the climate destroying infrastructures that exist in my neighborhood, such as an on-ramp to a highway, a water treatment plant and the major bus depot for the Metropolitan Transportation Agency in New York City. So all of these incredibly polluting factors that I felt like I had no control over. And I just thought that the way that the city and my neighborhood was mapped out, it was just by happenstance. And it was as I got older, I realized, no, that was purposeful. That's environmental racism. And the way urban planning is situated, these things are very purposeful as to the communities that live around these infrastructures. And it made me very upset that not only did I not have the language to talk about it, but those in my community just also similarly felt that they could do nothing about the way our community was situated. So I felt that becoming an elected official was the way that I could give agency around that and create a public health approach. I'm getting my master's in public health. So as a lifelong public health scholar, I wanted to bring that public health knowledge and awareness to my community and say, you know, the way that immigrant communities are taught and raised is to be silent, to be quiet, to be invisible, to not raise a flag. And I wanted to dismantle that notion and say, no, we can be loud, we can be proud, we can advocate for our community, and we can advocate for our community together. We don't necessarily need, you know, the mayor to do a walkabout tour and to give us sort of this tokenized press. We can have our own electeds from our community become the leaders and do something about what's happening in our community.
And so you've chosen your theater of activism and engagement to be the public realm as an elected official. Mm-hmm. As you made the transition from being a person who was organizing to being a person who bore the responsibilities, yes, of being elected and having to represent your full constituency and having to balance and trade off on, you know, just what governance, yes, means. What has that taught you? What's been interesting about that? What's been unexpected about that?
Yes, I think the way that I observed my leaders in the States is that I felt like activism and organizing had to be inherently separate from political organizing. And doing this work myself, I realized that that's actually not true. The very things that make me a good organizer, the empathy, the listening, the not being unwilling to compromise, being there in person and putting my own humanity on the line, bringing in those same qualities to my governance as an elected official, I believe is what makes me a good elected official. It makes me someone that my community wants to reelect. It makes me someone who they can trust. And my hope is that as more Gen Z members begin to run campaigns and to go into Congress and Parliament, that we bring that organizing passion and fire into our governance and really sort of merge those two qualities together.
How was your experience at COP? Tell us, I had the great privilege of watching you on a panel of these exceptional women of color, young women of color, yes, being in a conversation with Emma Watson at the New York Times Climate Hub. And I was struck by this palette and this image of the future having a voice. And I was very moved by that. But I should imagine that reception you got there was not necessarily the same reception you got at the official COP experience. So tell us about that.
Yes, my official COP experience at the Blue Zone was quite horrible, to be honest. I went into COP understanding that it's never sort of the most appropriate to put all your hopes in these negotiations because they tend to be a little bit of formality, a little bit of change, and an interesting mix of both. And however, I was still excited to be present and to be able to be at the conference. But the minute that I arrived, I was very keenly aware that COP was not meant for people like myself, disabled individuals, individuals of color, women. One of the members at the security gate, he even questioned my disability. And this is a notion that I've heard from other disabled observers, saying that security was very, very discriminatory and rude in asking disabled folks to prove their disabilities and prove why they should be able to, you know, accelerate the line and things of that nature. And additionally, there's a lift to get up a couple steps upon the entrance of COP, and that lift got stuck multiple times. It happened to myself. It happened to other members who were also trying to attend the negotiations. I was also really disheartened by the sort of subtle greenwashing that was happening within inside the COP itself. When you walk into the pavilion space and you see the various country pavilions, it was very clear which countries are the polluters and then which countries come from the global south and come from countries who are experiencing the pollution. You know, countries like the States and Australia and some of the greatest polluters, they had amazing, elaborate, beautiful pavilions, while pavilions of countries from the global south were very tiny and could barely hold a couple members of the constituency. And it made me very saddened to see that the way that we talk about who is in the hierarchy of who can solve the climate crisis was equally, if not more, overtly displayed within the COP itself. It was also very frustrating to see that the COP organizers didn't seem to have the intention of wanting the most amount of observers to be part of the conversation itself. There was a cap at the number of people who could be at certain negotiations. And I get that that's at some point for safety, especially during a pandemic. But then there was a live stream for folks literally 100 feet away from the conversation to be able to listen. And I thought that was kind of absurd. We're all in a space. We've spent thousands of dollars to come here to get flights, to get lodging, and we can't even be part of these conversations. And then we think about access to technology and even having a Wi-Fi or a VPN to be able to access these live streams. Individuals from the global south, indigenous individuals, might not have access to these technologies to be able to pull out a laptop, an iPad, an iPhone, to quickly click on a link and watch a live stream. And it begs the question, why aren't we equitably included in the first place? It's incredibly frustrating.
So I want to ask you a kind of final question about a theory of change from the point of view of politics. Sitting where I've sitting been watching the legislative process in the United States and watching a $150 billion coal transition plan, carefully constructed, thoughtfully done, scuppered by a certain senator from West Virginia who owns coal stocks and is seeking to preserve the jobs of a group of people who should be taken care of and should have their rights and needs be paid attention to, but there are many, many ways you can do that in a way that is consistent with a just transition.
Yes.
And to see that scuppered has really shocked my faith in the mechanics of the United States.
Yes.
To deal with the climate crisis. And it goes sort of back to our start of our conversation. So tell us about, given you're so much closer to it, how you feel about the prospects of really suitably progressive climate legislation getting through the United States in the current congressional lineup.
I currently am not very hopeful, and that makes me sad. I want to have hope. I want to have hope in my country's governments to be able to be leaders in climate solutions. But however, as you mentioned, that one particular representative, I think that is the key problem. One person in our electoral politics should not be able to govern the entire direction of a decision that not only impacts our nation, but impacts the globe. And I think that representative's view of being very selfish and thinking that he is only affecting the outcomes of his country, he's not. He's affecting the outcomes of the whole entire globe. And how sort of mean-spirited and selfish do you have to be able to uphold that weight? However, I do think that we are moving towards a space where we understand that the lobbying and the grip that certain fossil fuel industries have on our elected official is the true danger that has led us to be where we are now. I think people are becoming more aware of that, and we are loosening our grips on focusing towards individualized action, and we're realizing that truly to solve the climate crisis, we have to divest. And I'm hoping that that shift in narrative and shift in education and dismantling disinformation around the climate crisis will lead us to hopefully overcome individual barriers like this representative. And I think not to sound like a broken record, but I think this is where the young people do have an amazing opportunity to change the narrative of our governance in the States and other democratic strongholds across the globe, where not only are we holding our electeds accountable, but we are also then becoming the electeds. And that's what gives me hope and gives me hope for the future, that, you know, individuals like this senator won't be around for too much longer, and that the person who takes their place is a person of my generation that believes in equitable transition, a just transition, and is willing to compromise. I think that's the key, compromise. And to understand that holding those positions are an immense privilege. I think the notion of that privilege has been long lost on many of these men, who have taken for granted their re-election and re-election, and are just sort of holding on because they cannot see themselves in any other facet. But hopefully their reins will loosen and Gen Z will come in and we will do what we've always been trying to do.
That is an absolutely beautiful note to end on. Thank you for being here. Thank you for speaking out on behalf of a set of voices that are too often both forgotten and marginalized. And thank you also for the courage of being in office and and representing. And, I have the inverse experience of yours, that if you're in office, it gives me hope that at least there will be people there who will be carrying the banner forward.
Yes.
And that the distinction between representation and organizing is one that you are refusing to accept and carrying that spirit into your office.
Yes, I mean, I think that the spirit of both of those things are something that are constantly trying to be dismantled, where they kind of want us to just be another cog in the wheel, to be disillusioned, to be angry, and it's no. We're fighting back not only with hope, but with spirit and liveliness, and we're not letting that hope be diminished within our generation.
Those are beautiful final words.
Thank you.
Safe travels back home.
Thank you very much.
And we'll continue to root from you on both sides of the Atlantic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for watching. This has been a special impromptu session that we've done straight after a wonderful debate that we had here in the New York Times Climate Hub. For more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please look at theconduit.com. And thank you for joining us from this live broadcast here from COP.